This is an ABC podcast.
Staying at home, not seeing anyone, can be a very lonely experience. So you need to find creative ways to reach beyond the four walls.
One thing, you know, that's really fabulous that we're seeing now is a lot of organisations putting out live streaming content. For example, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra just had a live free symphony on Monday night, which people could tune into. The Zoo is making available live streams of their penguins and baby snow leopards. So we can tune into this content, but we can also bring other people along with that journey. I think supporting artists who have had to have shows cancelled due to this process but who are putting content online is something that we can do. That connects us with other people who are interested in those kinds of things, but it can also give back to someone who really, really needs our help at the moment. So just thinking about how we can practice kindness and compassion in this crazy time is a really good mindset for us to try and come at this with.
Welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Loneliness is a common experience, even in the best of times. And these are not the best of times, as we isolate ourselves from other people to defeat this virus. This discussion on the psychology of loneliness is moderated by Lynn Malcolm from All in the Mind. The speakers are social psychologist Dr. Katie Greenaway from the University of Melbourne, Sam Fredericks, the acting chief executive officer of On the Line, a national telephone and online support service, and Dr. Robert Ayres, a postdoctoral research fellow from Swinburne University.
Loneliness is a subjective negative experience of feeling like we are disconnected from the people around us. It's something that everybody experiences to some extent, and so in that sense it's quite a common experience for people to have. Now, because it is quite a common experience, it has an evolutionary drive, in a sense, for us to seek out connections. Just as food is for hunger and water is for thirst, loneliness is our sense of need to meet other people and feel connected. Now, when that has been removed or we feel like we are experiencing loneliness, this has a big impact on a range of different parts of our experience in life. It impacts our mental health as well as our physical health. And it can be something that carries along with us for quite a long time. So in terms of our mental health, it has impacts on our sense of depression or our mood, our anxiety, and even things like paranoia. And with our physical health, it can have impacts on our blood pressure, as mentioned earlier, and cholesterol, hypertension, and things like this.
Mm. And some people can feel lonely even when they're surrounded by people. Can you please explain why this can happen?
I guess the important thing to make clear here is that loneliness isn't the same as being alone or synonymous with something that doesn't happen when you're around other people. Because it is a subjective experience, anybody can feel lonely at any given time. And when we do feel lonely, what often happens is that we seek out information to try to convince us that we are feeling lonely. So it's almost like a cycle. When we feel lonely, we start to look at the situations that we are in with the people around us, and we start to pick up on evidence that they might not be engaged in the conversation or that we might not be sharing the same sort of experience. This in turn makes us feel a little bit more lonely and then makes us be a little bit more hypervigilant to those social cues. And by doing so, it creates a bit more of a distance between us and the people around us. So regardless of whether you're alone or not, anybody can feel lonely at any given time. Just as the case is, if you're alone, you might not necessarily feel lonely because you might feel quite content being in that space by yourself.
Sam Fredericks, it seems bizarre that in the age of social media, where the ability to remain connected 24/7 and interact with people from across the globe is constantly improving, your organisation is receiving double the traffic in people contacting you to address issues of loneliness. Do you get a sense of why we're seeing this now?
Yeah, we do, Lynn. The thing about social media is that it absolutely enables people to be more connected. but its focus is on quantity of communications and connection rather than on the quality. So social media users might have hundreds or even thousands of connections or friends on their different channels, but the way they communicate with them is much more likely to be a really public messaging style rather than the much more intimate form of communication that you would use when you were building a meaningful relationship with somebody. So what I'm saying, Lynn, is that we're more connected than ever before, but social media tends not to build meaningful relationships, and people are becoming lonelier.
So there seems to be an inauthenticity that seems to have built up through social media.
It certainly doesn't provide the opportunity to really connect with people. Most often you won't have a one-on-one conversation. You might not see the people that you're talking to, so you don't really have a chance to build a proper friendship or ongoing relationship or even check in with those people regularly.
Katie Greenaway, loneliness is a universal human emotion that's both complex and unique to each individual and has no single common cause. So what are some of the factors that can lead to loneliness?
There's a number of different things. I mean, as Robbie's already said, it's possible to feel lonely even when you're with other people. So other people aren't necessarily always the source of our loneliness. A lot of it comes to do with the way that we interpret the social stimulus that we're given. So we might have an interaction with someone and have a thought process or way of thinking about that is maybe geared towards feeling as though we don't connect so well with that person. So a lot of it is to do with how we interpret social stimulus. And so the good news of that is sometimes we can change the way that we think about those interactions. Also, I think, you know, as Sam mentioned, when we have conversations or ways of connecting with people that don't necessarily feel authentic or really meaningful and do tend to feel superficial, those are often predictors of feeling a little bit more disconnected from others, or as though we're not really kind of vibing on the same level. And so there, I think, again, it's a really good lesson to learn that if we want to connect with others, sometimes we do need to open up and be a little bit vulnerable, to self-disclose, to discuss with others maybe things that we were keeping to ourselves before, and we can turn some of those more sometimes negative interactions into positive ones.
Robbie, your research team published the Young Australian Loneliness Survey last year, which indicated young adults reported higher levels of loneliness, social isolation, social anxiety, and depressive symptoms than adolescents aged, say, between 12 and 17. Why is it that we're seeing higher rates in those aged from, say, 18 to 25? And does that have anything to do with the end of a routine, perhaps, that was provided in a school setting?
For a lot of young people in that age group of 18 to 25, they're experiencing a lot of changes in their lives. So they're making a transition from high school to university or another education system, or they're moving towards employment, or they're moving out of home. And these are all regular processes that people go through. They're quite normal behaviours. But sometimes it can be a little bit too isolating in that sense. So when we feel like we are struggling, for example, going from a very structured environment like school, where you're surrounded by people all the time, about peers who share similar sorts of views as you, and then you go into a university lecture theatre where there's somewhat thousands of people, you don't really know them, it can cause a sort of a sense of, oh, nobody here understands me or nobody gets me. And one thing I guess this really relates to is this idea that both Sam and Katie were really highlighting, is that loneliness is more to do with the quality of the connections that we have, not so much the quantity. So you can have one person in your life that you feel really connected to and not feel lonely ever. Or you could have multiple people that you engage with but feel like no one's on the same page as you. And I feel like when you are going from an institution like high school into adulthood, you're constantly having that challenged. You're always around your peers who you shared a lot in common with, and now you're being put into situations where you might not be able to recognise so easily that you have a strong connection with these people. So I feel like in that sense, yeah, the sheer number of these experiences that this demographic go through, it's just a lot more than what we would typically see in other age groups.
Mm. If I could, I'm sorry, just add, certainly, you know, we see those elevated levels in that particular group, but I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, that's a moment of transition for people, and there's a lot of other times of transition in life that we know are risk factors for, you know, feeling more disconnected from others or a sense of loneliness. Parenthood is often one, so transitioning to a new kind of family unit. Divorce is another. Retirement. I think what we're all going through at the moment is one such transitional case. And so it's important to pay attention to the kinds of times of life where we might be at risk of feeling a little bit more disconnected and then putting procedures in place to deal with that.
Mm. One group is the elderly. People may have pre-existing mental health concerns. So what's an example of the way we might anticipate the sorts of experiences that, say, the elderly will go through?
Well, I think really anything that involves a shift in someone's social environment or social network is probably a big thing to pay attention to. So in the case of, elderly people, certainly some people are extremely well connected and really make an effort to stay involved in their community or with other groups in their lives. And that's a really great thing to do. Of course, at the moment, that's something that is increasingly difficult for people to do. So getting together with the local book club or aqua aerobics group or other gatherings is extremely difficult. And so finding ways of achieving that connectedness, I think, is going to be incredibly important so that people still feel are able to engage in those relationships, even if they're not necessarily physically present with one another.
And another transition in life is being a young parent, and that also raises a lot of questions around self-identity. Who am I now? What are some of the things that people might encounter there, and what sorts of things could be helpful in that scenario?
Yeah, well, I'm keen to hear what you guys think about this as well, but certainly that's a massive transition for people. Often it involves, in some cases, necessarily withdrawing from some previous social engagements because your focus is now on the family unit and having that, you know, come first. In that sense, I think, you know, reaching out for support is incredibly important, and really, again, being willing to be vulnerable with people and letting them know that you need assistance. This goes not only for new parents, but I think also for anyone who's in a situation where they're, you know, perhaps not coping or maybe even worried about not coping. When we can foresee rocky shores ahead, that's probably when we should be investing in trying to find ways of improving that.
But sure. Yes, of course, we all feel lonely. It's a universal human condition at some stage in our lives. What can people do when they feel lonely to try and help them with that experience, deal with it?
It's a very interesting question. And the thing is that there's no one sure answer that's going to suit everybody. And this, again, is because loneliness is impacted by a multitude of different factors. For some people, it's that transition into parenthood or from retirement. For others, it's because they actually have moved overseas and they're away from the people that they feel so connected with. So how we address loneliness in this sense is always going to be very different. I think it's also really important to think about how we can go about, you know, intervening with loneliness at different levels. So we can look at it as an individual, but also with our relationships and even as high up as our society and societal changes that can happen. If we think about an individual and how they're feeling lonely, for some people, it might be this idea that they are really switched on to how people are responding to them. And if that's the case, it might be a really useful technique to focus more on identifying those negative thoughts that they're experiencing about, see, they don't understand me, nobody gets me, and really working on that. But that might not necessarily be useful for somebody who's having more interpersonal differences or difficulties and feeling loneliness in that sense. So rather than there being a one-size-fits-all approach, it has to be a targeted approach to the person's unique experiences. And I think this is what we see quite across the board. you know, Katie mentioned earlier about the different transitions that you have, and I think that's a really good example. You know, if you're targeting loneliness in an older person, what's going to be useful for them is going to be very different to what's useful for a younger person. And that's because they've experienced a whole range of different things and their sense of loneliness might be coming from a different place.
So, Katie, you've actually worked on some interventions to increase social connectedness. What do these involve?
Well, this is work that's in affiliation with the University of Queensland as well as the University of Melbourne, focusing really on the group level. So how can we get people connecting with groups? As Robbie mentioned, you know, there is work that we can do with individuals in terms of helping them connect interpersonally with other individuals. But another pathway that we can think about addressing social connectedness is with larger groups of people, where it's not just an interchange one-on-one relationship, but this is a cluster of individuals that I can turn to for assistance and help. And so we often tend to focus on helping people see the benefits that groups can have in their life for well-being, for productivity, for ability to engage with information effectively and get resources that they need, and how to leverage that into joining groups and having groups be more part of their lives. And a really big part of this, I think, you know, going back to, again, what Robbie was saying about, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. Really what we do at the start of this process is try and get people to reflect on how their current social situation is going. So what are the groups or social connections in their life like at the moment? People can do this at home. You can just literally map them out, or you can write them down as a list and see what are the most meaningful and important connections for you. And reflecting on yourself as an individual, what you enjoy, what you like, what you get, you know, energy from and excitement from, and just seeing whether the social connections in your life are really mapping onto what you're enjoying, because that could be a gap for people. You know, if I find that reading is a really important part of, you know, who I am and what I get you know, joy from, then maybe I can start a group about books or about movies or pop culture or, you know, whatever people are interested in. So that's kind of a pathway into thinking about how we can be connected with people that doesn't involve just going up to someone and saying, hey, do you want to be friends? Which is sometimes a good strategy, but it's also sometimes useful to have a reason for contacting people and connecting with them so that you can kind of structure it around some kind of activity or shared interest that you have.
It's very important to have a structure, I guess.
Yeah.
If I may, sorry.
Yes.
Katie, you raised a really good point about, you know, you needing to feel that identity and experience that, but I think it's really important to also highlight that if you are to map out your connections and you are particularly low, that's going to be a very difficult process for you to do. So by all means, I absolutely agree. Like, for some people, it's very suited. But if you're experiencing problematic levels of loneliness, trying to figure out what friendships give you joy is going to be a difficult process.
No, that's absolutely true. And there, I think, you know, something like On the Line, for example, can come in extremely handy as a resource to reach out to and to talk to people about this kind of experience, or of course getting, for example, you know, a clinical psychologist and discussing these kinds of issues. And so I definitely recommend people who are experiencing really what they feel to be problematic levels of loneliness to do that.
So, Sam, in online, what sorts of things have you come up with that you can do, say, in schools or workplaces to instill good social interaction skills in people?
Yeah, I think that probably children are actually really good at, schools are certainly good at teaching children social interaction skills via, you know, just normal play and learning how to develop empathy and learning communication skills like listening and building friendships from that. And we tend then not to focus on it so much at work, but actually the same principles still apply. So even when you're at work, you need to look for opportunities, whether it's a formal opportunity that the company puts together for you or a group of like-minded employees, start to develop groups that are working together to problem solve something, or a maybe it might be a sporting team that you do so that you can bond with other people on a like-minded topic and then start to build more meaningful relationships with them. And at our work, for example, we have a self-care well-being group, and they do themed interactions each month. So this month we've celebrated Mardi Gras right across the organisation. And a few months ago we celebrated Harry Potter Month, which was amazingly successful because everybody was interested and everybody interacted, and you got to make connections with people that you might not otherwise have had a chance to talk to.
So to what extent would you, say, encourage workplaces to take it as their responsibility to introduce some of these interactive connections?
I think it's a bottom-up and a top-down approach. So it can be led both by the staff and workers themselves, but also in conjunction with management, making or creating an environment and a culture where that's actually celebrated and supported.
And do you get a sense that this is being taken on at a societal level, that things are starting to shift and there's a greater awareness that there's a need to...
I do think that there is a greater awareness, or certainly becoming a greater awareness, that people are lonely and what that actually means. So there's an understanding from the community, I think, these days. And we've done some commissioned research recently that confirmed this, that people are understanding that loneliness is a social issue, and about the quality of your relationships with yourself, the people you love, the community that you live in. And it's different to, say, mental health. But people are thinking that they wouldn't necessarily seek help for loneliness. They'd want to talk to people that they care about because they don't trust that external people are not going to judge them. They feel like they've got to sort it out for themselves. So I think that there's... that kind of confounds the whole issue, and that really there needs to be greater awareness that talking about it is exactly what's going to help to solve the issue.
Right. People are sort of, you know, our social relationships are both the problem and the cure.
That's right.
You're listening to a discussion on the psychology of loneliness from the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. The speakers are social psychologist Dr. Katie Greenaway from the University of Melbourne, Sam Fredericks, the acting CEO of On the Line, a national telephone online support service, and Dr. Robert Ayres, a postdoctoral research fellow at Swinburne University. For health and longevity, strong social connections are up there with diet and exercise, but it's not always easy to admit you're lonely or to find ways to remedy it. Moderator Lynn Malcolm takes this up with the panel.
There's a stigma around feeling lonely, and almost people are a bit ashamed of feeling lonely, that perhaps they shouldn't feel lonely.
Yeah, but the irony is everyone does at one point or another, and so normalising it, discussing it, raising it. Other people, this is, you know, one study that I love that I read about last year is essentially 25 studies, failed studies on trying to get people to perspective take other people's perspectives. And the only intervention that actually works is if I tell you, Lynn, this is what I'm thinking and feeling right now, and then you can say, oh, Katie, it sounds like you're thinking and feeling this right now. And so we can't expect other people to be mind readers and to know when we're feeling a certain way. It does really require us to be brave and vulnerable sometimes and tell people, hey, I'm not coping, or I am feeling a little bit disconnected. You know, can you help me do something about that?
I think that's a really, really good point. And one thing I think that's important to raise also is that part of this stigma might actually come from people not recognising that they are lonely. Because we see a lot in research that when people ask, well, respond to the question, are you lonely? Everyone gives a different response, because there is that social desirability almost to be like, no, I'm not lonely, I'm doing this fine. But when we use multiple items or measures to identify if someone is lonely, to ask, you know, do you lack companionship, or do you have this sense that people are you're in tune with others around you, then we get a much more comprehensive look. And so, you know, it's one thing to really highlight this idea that, yeah, I'm expressing your emotion and how you're feeling lonely, but if you can't identify that you're lonely, that's a big problem as well, because then you can't seek that assistance that you need. And I think that's why things like the Australian Coalition to End Loneliness, which Michelle Lim is the scientific chair on, their priority is really raising this awareness and trying to help people identify like what loneliness actually looks like, so we can really tackle and buffer against this, the stigma associated with it, because it ultimately has really long-term effects on your health and well-being.
And I think it's also a good thing for people to keep in mind that, you know, we do need to pay attention to social health as much as we do physical health. And just like you go to the doctor and get a physical checkup every now and then, we should be doing a social checkup every now and then. And sometimes you realize, hey, I have been feeling a little bit off. Mm. And maybe the cause isn't necessarily that I'm feeling socially disconnected, but certainly being a little bit more, reaching out to people who we haven't talked to for a while, can also help target those feelings as well, even if they're not the cause of those feelings.
Mm. Absolutely, you're
and
right.
And what's come out in your research is that people, it's quite surprising, isn't it, really, that you can be physically affected, you can be made physically sick by
Absolutely.
The feelings of loneliness.
Absolutely, I think, yeah, when we think about loneliness, it is a social health problem, but it is also a physical health problem, because they're all intertwined. And when we are constantly feeling lonely, then that has a big impact on our internal systems. Our flight and fight system goes crazy, because it thinks where everything is almost an attack against us to make us feel lonely. And when that's constantly activating, it sends off a lot of inflammatory markers throughout the body, which can really have a huge impact on our physical health. So you're right, it is like we do need to have these like social well-being checks. But also I think there's a responsibility to focus that if we do have some physical health conditions, how that may impact our social health as well, because it's definitely bi-directional in that sense. Mm. So targeting one might actually impact the other, and that's pretty much what we're seeing, yeah.
And we find, we find the same at On the Line with social health in both informing and being informed by people's mental and physical health status, so that if people have poor quality relationships around them, then they're more likely to express physical ill health symptoms, and the same with mental ill health.
And we were talking about the workplace. What about working remotely, Robbie? Can that have consequences on people's well-being, where they miss out on potential social interaction?
Yeah, I think it really can. If you think about a workplace, we spend a lot of time there and we forge a lot of connections there. Some might be good, some might not be good, but we still are interacting with people. And if we're working remotely, and we're almost removing those connections, that can have an impact on us. But I think it's always going to impact us in different ways. That's not to say that if you're working remotely that you're always going to feel lonely. It might be that you're feeling like, oh, I'm feeling really disconnected actually from my work. Like, there's this idea that if you enjoy your job, you're all working towards the same goal. And if you're not physically there, it might feel like you're not achieving that goal, or you're not contributing to that. So there are ways to mitigate that feeling, and I think one important way is, if you are going to work remotely, try to organise and schedule meetings like that are face-to-face. Telecommunications allow us to do that these days, and I think constantly responding over email might be a very efficient way to get a message across, but having the ability to see somebody face-to-face is actually really important for those needs, which might help reduce that impact of feeling lonely when you're working remotely. Mm-hmm.
And this discussion is very relevant right now in light of the developing situation of COVID-19. To each of you, what advice would you give to those listening as to how to stay connected in this time of uncertainty? And you may well be working remotely, working from home. First of all, Katie.
I've been on my soapbox about this all week, this term social distancing, and this is such an important thing to be doing at the moment, to, you know, keeping distance with other people, to, you know, working remotely if we can, certainly not being in, you know, large crowds of people if we can absolutely avoid it. What I
I don't like about that term is I think we should be talking about it as physically distancing, which is what we're doing. We're not socially distancing at all. In fact, it's more important than ever to be socially connected with others. And so really paying attention to our relationships with other people and making time and plans for those relationships is really key. Robbie was mentioning, you know, having these telecommunication meetings with people for work purposes. I think that's really important. But also one thing that we get at work often is this incidental social connections. We go for coffee with people or other kinds of activities. We run into people in the corridor and we can miss out on those. So even making time for that in a work context, having like a virtual coffee room where people can jump online and just have a break or say, hey, is anyone taking their lunch break and do they want to maybe, you know, chat over the phone while we do that. So building in those times to not just have like functional discussions with people, but also social chats. And I think that also goes for catching up with friends. We can still, you know, play board games or video games together virtually. Now we can watch Netflix at the same time together through various plugins in our browsers. There's a lot of ways that people can get creative, but I would say the number one thing is to really prioritize those social relationships while maintaining physical distance.
Yes, it is interesting because we're almost being asked to train ourselves into distance. And if you're trying to change your habits, even if it's a physical habit, it makes you psychologically feel like you need to be distant.
Absolutely,
as well.
But I think just as we can train ourselves into maintaining physical distance and good hygiene, we can also train ourselves into maintaining social connectedness. And so maybe we can develop habits around these that actually makes it effortless to stay in touch with other people. So it's also a mindset of how we can make this just a routine part of our everyday.
And Sam, this must be something that you've been dealing with for quite some time in your organisation.
Absolutely. And I think I agree with Katie and the suggestions that she's made as well. And I think that it is about, you can build a rapport with people across the telephone and across using technology, while social media doesn't give you the quality of relationships you want. You can, in fact, build a relationship on Skype or other things like FaceTime, where you can actually see people. And I think that that's really important, both in a work setting and also in a personal setting, to make sure that in these times where we may well be disconnected physically from each other, that we stay in touch with the people who are important to us, work-wise and personally-wise. I think we can't forget those sorts of things. If you're used to going out with your mates on the weekend and suddenly can't do those same things, then as Katie was saying, make time to watch a show or talk on the phone or just catch up and do something online together.
Robbie, in this situation with the COVID-19, it must raise many questions that you've already encountered in your research, but it must be highlighting those now for you.
Absolutely. I think, you know, some really great suggestions here about how to maintain that sense of connection. Again, I think it's really important to contextualise this situation. You know, this is something that's actually, it's going to be relatively short term. So the solutions that we've got to focus on here need to adapt to that. I think Katie made a great point, about calling up people and letting them know and that you're there and I'm feeling disconnected, all these virtual lunchrooms and things like that. And Sam, you alluded to that as well. It's really important though to focus on the content of what you're saying. And I think in these times, it's a really good opportunity for us to try to think about actively how we can strengthen the relationships that we actually have already. And some really good ways of doing this are things like expressing gratitude. It's such a powerful, powerful task that people can do, which has a big impact on the relationships that we have. But aside from that, there are other things we can do as well. If we have elderly parents and we have the resources right now to be able to do something, like get them into our family house or something like that, that's an opportunity to create that connection, because the needs for the older or the aging population or older adults is that they want that physical connection and that physical proximity with their loved ones to feel that quality relationship. There's also things like we've seen in Italy where people in apartment buildings are communicating with each other across. And that's also a really good way as well. I mean, if you have the ability to do that, is to talk to your neighbours through a fence or across a balcony or in ways where you can actually have those social needs met without the risk of this being physically close.
I think that's an excellent point, Robbie, that, yeah, we should focus on what we're saying to people, and it gets back to your point about it's about quality, not quantity. So reaching out to people a lot isn't necessarily going to give the same outcome as if you really make time to try and deepen that relationship with someone. So one thing that people can do if they're interested is look up something called the Fast Friends Paradigm, which is very fun. It's a social psychological practice that gives you 36 questions that you can ask one another that increase in terms of the level of disclosure and intimacy that it builds as you go through these discussions. I do this with friends sometimes. We just pull up a random question and you find you learn something new about someone, even if you have known them for ages. You haven't asked this specific question, so you get to know something about them. And another point is we don't just have to focus on interpersonal relationships or one-to-one relationships. We can also think about this on a group level. And one thing, you know, that's really fabulous that we're seeing now is a lot of organizations putting out live streaming content. For example, the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra just had a live free symphony on Monday night, which people could tune into. The Zoo is making available live streams of their penguins and baby snow leopards. So we can tune into this content, but we can also bring other people along with that journey. I think supporting artists who have had to have shows cancelled due to this process, but who are putting content online is something that we can do. That connects us with other people who are interested in those kinds of things, but it can also give back to someone who really, really needs our help at the moment. So just thinking about how we can practice kindness and compassion in this crazy time is, I think, a really good mindset for us to try and come at this with.
And I think people are very responsive to those positive moves at the moment. I think people are really appreciating the positive as well. So let's go to some of the questions that people have sent in. So Sam writes in, something that is happening is that people are so private, shy, or scared to express feelings or issues. How can we socially change this mindset to teach families to encourage this?
Yeah, I think that that's similar to the idea of the child's play and forming social interaction skills and developing your psychosocial skills through play. And I wonder if we could encourage families to do more things together and fun things as well, as a way of starting to just change the paradigm around how people interact, so that it's okay to talk about your feelings in relationships, in families. I think that it's perhaps a generational thing as well, and I certainly remember that in my parents' generation, it wasn't, you didn't tell people how you were feeling. It was, you had quite a strong role. Parents had a strong role within the family, and they had to be strong and looking after the children who should do children things. But really, you know, go and play or do their homework or whatever it was. So there was that sort of disconnection. And I think as we're becoming more aware of our emotional needs as a society, it's an opportunity to encourage families to really talk about their feelings and make that okay, not really normalise it.
Mm. And I think recognising too that there may be different ways of communicating. I have friends, for example, who really do hate talking to people on the phone. They wouldn't want to call someone up and have that conversation, but, you know, texting, they can really connect with people that way. So also recognizing that, you know, one person's way of being connected with others may not be our way. And I think that especially comes up in sort of generational divides as well. So having conversations with people about, you know, what do you need and how can I support that, and how can we have a conversation about, you know, making sure that we're all getting what we need in this relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I I agree with exactly what you guys are saying. I think it's also something as well is it's almost seen to be quite a vulnerable experience to express how you're feeling. And for a lot of people, that's it might be an intergenerational thing, it might be an individual differences thing, but for a lot of people, that's quite a scary experience to open up, especially when no one else is. So I think this idea of really starting early on and almost modelling this behaviour from a young age can really help encourage that it's okay to talk about your emotions, and that doesn't make you weak in any capacity. It actually makes you a very well-rounded, strong person to be able to do that and know what you're feeling, why, and what to do about it.
Summer has raised the issue around another form of transition, and that's migration, for example, which is very relevant to international students. They feel lonely whilst gaining new cultural understanding or experiencing cultural clash.
We absolutely see this in our experiences at university. You know, international students often do report feeling socially disconnected or lonely, and that does tend to go hand in hand with, you know, feeling a lack of well-being or a lack of belonging, and that can be a really hard experience. And so we often find that it's for these individuals that really focusing on social connection, maintaining the ones with, you know, people from home and staying in touch with people from home, but also trying to build social connections in the new environment is really beneficial. And I don't want to minimize that and pretend that it's easy. It's very difficult and it does require us being really vulnerable. But it's also an utter necessity of life to feel as though we belong and feel as though we're supported in our environment. And so I think really trying to reach out to, you know, formalized groups that already exist is a really good way to do this. Somewhere where you know that it's going to be a group of people who are interested in the kinds of things that you're interested in. It gives us a reason to be connected with other people that doesn't involve just rocking up to a bunch of strangers and saying, hey, can I, you know, join you? Which, I mean, hats off to the people who can do that, because the answer is almost always yes. We're actually usually pretty open and accepting of new people. It's just that we sometimes find it easier when we have a reason to get to know them.
With the international students in particular, they face a lot of specific barriers to connecting with other people. Often they already have this expectation that when they do come to study in a new country, that life is going to be like, I'm going to meet all these new people and it's going to be great. But then they realize, actually, I may need to work. And because I need to work, like, I'm only at that place for most of the time. And then I don't get to talk to my family back home because of the time difference. And that's really hard, while also trying to maintain good grades and all those different things that come with being a university student. And I think in that case, it's really, really hard. So as Katie's saying, if you have specific interests that you're interested in, try to seek those out, or people that might have that. And unfortunately for a lot of people, they don't know where to find that information.
Even meetup groups, for example, are a really great resource. There are different kind of community areas that people can go to seek out people who are interested in this. Or even trying to start a group on a specific thing is a good way to find out whether or not that group already exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, volunteering is often a really good way as well. So if you like animals, you know, you could volunteer at like the Lost Dogs Home or the Lord Smith or somewhere, and just meet other like-minded people.
Well, and that actually
doing something meaningful.
That's a bit of a twofer, because research shows that when we spend money on or do things for others, it actually makes us happier than when we spend money on or do things for ourselves. Yeah. So you're getting the dual benefit of, you know, becoming more socially connected, but also giving in a way that is, you know, in some ways selfish, because it's going to be increasing your own happiness and well-being.
Well, it gives you meaning. It gives you meaning in your life, and it gives you direction. And I think they're really important for people in particular to have. Once you have meaning, you have that sense of connection to something bigger than you.
Absolutely. It doesn't have to be individuals. It can be a cause.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Jasmine writes in about her elderly parents. My elderly parents seem to have socially distanced for the last 30 years of their lives. Ha ha, she says. I just thought they were introverts with mild depression. I don't know how to help them when they talk about missing friends, but they make no attempts to make friends. This is a hard one, isn't it?
It is, because you can't change... Jasmine can't change her parents' behaviour. She can absolutely model the behaviour that she'd like them to adopt, but really she can only choose to change her response to her parents.
I think in these cases, having really upfront conversations about this can sometimes be helpful, because you can understand a little more why people don't want to do the behaviours that they're not doing, or what the barriers are for them to not doing those behaviours. And they can also hear why you're concerned about those issues. And then getting all of those problems out on the table, you can start to address those barriers or concerns one by one and try and break it down in that sense, rather than having a global issue that seems insurmountable. If you break it down into smaller pieces and say, okay, well, one barrier is we don't feel like we have the time to meet with people. Okay, what if we put aside this time to do X? Or another might be, oh, well, they never get in touch with me. It might say, okay, well, it involves someone starting the conversation. So what if you reached out now and, you know, sent a message or gave that person a call? Or, you know, there can be kind of concrete actions that you can try and take once you understand the scope of the problem. That could be one way forward.
Mm. It's almost about helping them change this lifelong habit in a way, sort of change that mindset to just break out of it.
Yeah, I mean, we know from behaviour change that if you make problems concrete, so you don't say, for example, I'm going to exercise more, you say, I'm going to walk around the block 3 times every day. And you make a time and a plan to do that. And so making these big problems that can seem quite abstract into very concrete, actionable behaviours, all of a sudden you're starting to develop new habits, and that's when that can sometimes shift into, you know, more global behaviour.
Jane asks, how does loneliness correspond with alcohol and substance abuse?
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think for a lot of young people that's quite a pertinent experience for them. I guess this is my own opinion in this sense, but it almost makes sense to me that if you are struggling with loneliness and one thing that makes you feel a little bit more connected is drinking with people in a bar, then you might rely on that to try to make connections, to feel that feeling of connectedness. It might not be the best approach though, and that's the concerning thing. So for some people it might actually be the case that the lonelier you are, the more you're relying on some of these substances.
Rajid says, I live in Swan Hill and I have experienced lots of racism and denigration when I moved there and felt very lonely for about 3 years. I didn't know I was lonely until I made a real friend. I think sometimes people don't realise they're lonely and just think they're depressed. Is depression very closely linked with loneliness?
It is very much related. I guess a big part of that depression is that lack of motivation and that the lowered mood and things that might actually sever a sense of connectivity. And I think it's what's quite interesting is some of the work that's been conducted within the lab is that loneliness can predict depression at a subsequent time point. But something that was quite interesting is that social anxiety seems to be quite related also to this feeling of loneliness. And I think if we take a step back and think about it as in a social situation, if you are socially anxious, you might actually be thinking a lot about what other people are thinking about you. And that might be quite a scary experience because you might be going, oh, they don't like what I'm saying. They rolled their eyes or they yawned. Like, that I must be boring them or something like that. It's a very similar process to loneliness.
And I mean, just to link that with issues of discrimination, I mean, this sounds like a real case where that, of course, that would be absolutely anxiety provoking and, you know, have a lot of really terrible consequences. And I think, you know, that's absolutely not okay that
this experience is happening, but it's also a very real experience, and it's one that it's important to acknowledge that as that is really difficult to have had that experience, and also to be dealing with the anxiety that goes along with that. And of course, that's going to be an impactful factor on the development of loneliness, as well as loneliness contributing to further anxiety around interacting with people, because we don't know if they're safe or not. So I think that's a really unfortunate experience to have had. Mm. And do you find that, Sam, with people calling on the line, that sometimes they say things like, I feel depressed or things, but kind of when you get down to it, it seems like maybe there is social disconnection at the root of it?
The broad categories of social health that we monitor people, and people disclose that they're experiencing hopelessness or disconnection or loneliness. And while they're separate, but obviously related. And of those, the people who are feeling really hopeless are those who are most likely to also be depressed or to report that they are feeling depressed. And I think one of the things that Robbie was saying about if people have social anxiety as well, then they connect in really different ways for us. So they're more likely to use, say, a chat connection, and they don't want to talk on the phone, but they will just talk on chat. And if there's any mention of moving to phone because they sound like they might be escalating, then they'll disconnect altogether. So that's quite a specialist skill, to be able to engage with people who are socially anxious on web chat and help them to feel a little better.
We'll finish on this one. Kerry is interested in what type of research projects in loneliness are available to students. What else needs to be figured out?
Well, one question that I'm really interested in at the moment is using experience sampling technology to assess loneliness. So this is a methodology where we contact people multiple times a day, usually via their smartphones, and just say, hey, how are you feeling at the moment? How lonely are you feeling at the moment? Are you with people at the moment? What was the last time you spoke to someone? And seeing how these experiences fluctuate over the day. A lot of the research that we've used to look at this problem so far have been correlational or cross-sectional, looking at people at one point in time, or looking at people over longer periods of time, as Robbie alluded to before. We don't necessarily have more fine-grained analysis. Some people have done this research, but it's really kind of at the cutting edge now. And one thing that I'm really intrigued about in that specific space is looking at partitioning variants to do with how much of loneliness is associated with different individuals. So me being more lonely than you, for example, and how much of it is within person variation, which is my loneliness levels and how they track differently across time. We can actually partition those two sources of variance and figure out how much of loneliness in general is due to people being different and how much of it is due to people varying over time. And the preliminary evidence that we're looking at now suggests that it's more to do with how much people vary over time than it is to do with people necessarily being different. That is a source of variance, but around about 60% of it seems to be due to how much we fluctuate. And so to me, that suggests that interventions around loneliness aren't necessarily geared towards certain groups of people or certain types of individuals, but more to do with predicting when in people's everyday lives they're more likely to feel lonely, and being able to target them at the right time.
Social psychologist Dr. Katie Greenaway wrapping up that discussion presented by the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. That's it for this Big Ideas. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Barclay, hoping there may be an upside to this enforced time at home, and that's a chance to build stronger relationships with the people you live with. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.